Hello, it's Thursday, March the 4th, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. And if my voice sounds familiar to you, that's a good sign. That means you've been listening to Hoover podcasts the last couple of years, one in particular that I did called Area 45. But with the departure of the 45th president, we had to revamp Area 45, and its successor is what you're listening to now, Matters of Policy and Politics. And we hope that you enjoy it. By the way, this is not the only Hoover Institution podcast in town. Go to the Hoover website, and you'll find just a whole bunch of great stuff to listen to. There's Econ Talk with Russell Roberts. There is The Grumpy Economist with John Cochran. The Libertarian with Victor Davis Hanson. Pacific Century with Misha Oslin and John Yoo. And last and hopefully not least, the audio form of Goodfellas, the weekly broadcast that I do with Neil Ferguson, H.R. McMaster, and John Cochran. If you want to subscribe to any or all of them, pretty simple. Go to the Hoover Institution's website, hoover.org. Click on the Publications tab, then you'll see another link to podcasts. Go there. You can subscribe to any or all. You can also sign up for the monthly email that we do for you, which we call a Pod Blast, which sends the best of our podcasts to you. And hopefully this podcast makes the cut. Hoover Institution podcast, just one part of Ideas Defining a Free Society. Now, if he's still with me, if he hasn't checked out during that long spiel, is my friend and colleague, Russell Berman. Russell Berman is the Walter A. Haas Professor in Humanities at Stanford University. He's a senior fellow here at the Hoover Institution and co-chair of the Working Group on Islamism and the International Order. At Stanford, he is a member of both the Department of German Studies and the Department of Comparative Literature, and he studies politics and culture in Europe as well as the Middle East. Russell, thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Happy to be here, Bill.
And you report to me that you're alive and doing well in San Francisco with COVID shots and all just couldn't be better, right?
It's the most perfect of all worlds.
Well, I miss having you around the campus. We like to get together and see you in person at some point, my friend. So when we're open, let's get together and catch up, okay?
Sure.
Let's look at Europe, Russell. And I think the timing here is good because just anecdotally, I'm talking to friends who are now talking about traveling to Europe this summer. That includes my dear sister, who's going to kill me for saying this, but she is part of what we call the active elderly. She is retiring and she is now gravitated toward river cruises, Russell. She wants to do one through Germany and Austria in this summer. And then she wants to do one on the Seine. She wants to go from Paris to Normandy. And at all times, they're kind of figuring out whether or not to go because they're not sure about COVID. They're not sure about what's going to be open then. So that's just one aspect of Europe. But let's begin with this, Russell. There is this MO in the Biden administration, at least it seems to me there's an MO, that they inherited a mess. Anything you talk about in regards to what they picked up from Donald Trump and moved forward, it was a mess. They had to put together the pieces and try to figure out a way forward. You certainly see this on COVID, where they suggested all times there just was not a vaccine strategy in place. We were not doing shots. The president seems to have forgotten that he got a shot while Donald Trump was president. And this also translates into foreign affairs as well. You see this Iran, for example. We have to pick up the pieces on this. So here's the question. Russell, when we talk about the transatlantic alliance, when we talk about America's relationship with Western European nations, is the Biden administration walking into a mess or are they walking into a work in progress?
It's a good question. The transatlantic relations are vital to the United States. The Biden administration tends to present them as if Donald Trump had destroyed them all and it only left them with a mess in general. The Biden administration certainly inherited some problems. That's why it's called a job. But there were certainly successes in the Trump administration, and there are, in any case, always continuities in foreign policy from administration to administration, regardless of the parties in power. In addition, I should add that the Biden administration seems to be masterful at blaming all the difficulties it faces on its predecessor. Right. It decided to take this job, or Biden decided to take the job, or someone decided that Biden should take the job. And the job is not an easy job, no matter what. But let's get back to Europe. As I said before, relations between the United States and Europe are important, a major trading partner, long historical connections, crucial to mutual security architecture. I don't think anybody in either administration would disagree with that. What has changed is that the Cold War came to an end. Russian troops weren't in the middle of Europe. They were pushed back outside of Europe. That is to say, the front line in Europe vis-a-vis Russia moved far to the east. So it only made sense for the Trump administration to cultivate ties to the band of countries on the eastern flank of the European Union, from the Baltics in the north to Bulgaria in the south. We could add Greece to that. It doesn't quite fit that paradigm, but it became a major ally thanks to the Trump administration. Right. What that meant was shifting attention away from what Donald Rumsfeld called old Europe, that is France and Germany, and to Poland and Romania, important allies now. Right. The Biden team seems to want to move back to Paris and Berlin. Paris is a lovely city, and I hope your sister has a good time there.
What evidence, yep, Russell, do you have that they want to shift back to old Europe? I mean, is it what rhetoric have you heard? What indications have you seen that they do want to move more Western on the continent?
Oh, well, the initial meetings between Blinken and the foreign secretaries was with the French and the German. The focus has been on France and Germany, this has been baked into the cake from the start. The question will be: Are they going to drop the Eastern Europeans, or are they going to stick with them? That's unclear at this point. Yes.
Can you? I'm sorry, Nora. Can you multitask the two? Can you be both active with old Europe and new Europe?
Sure you can. Although there are some big points of contention, one of them being the pipeline from Russia to Germany, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which both the Obama administration and the Trump administration insisted on blocking. It's nearly completed. It's not complete. It's under congressional sanctions that were passed with an extraordinary bipartisan majority under Trump. And the question is whether the Biden administration is going to stick with its opposition to Nord Stream. And the reason why this is an answer to your question is that the German leadership is in love with Nord Stream. It wants it to happen. The Polish leadership, both the current Polish leadership and its opponents in the previous Polish administration, Foreign Minister Sikorski, for example, hate this because they see this as a German-Russian pact around Poland. Indeed,
that sounds familiar.
Well, Sikorski, and let's remember, he's the in American terms, the liberal foreign minister, not belonging to the current conservative government in Poland. Sikorski called this he compared it explicitly to the Hitler-Stalin Pact. The East Europeans, the Poles and the Balts particularly, have good reason to be worrisome about too cozy relationship between Germany and Russia. So what does this mean for the Biden administration foreign policy in Europe? Will it stick with the Poles and stick with the Trump administration and the Obama administration in opposing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline? Or is it going to punt and accommodate Berlin? We'll see.
Russell, I understand the political benefits of abundant natural gas, but since when have the Germans trusted the Russians to the point of being dependent upon them for energy?
Well, you know, the head of Gazprom includes a former German chancellor, Gerhard Schröder. When he was in power at the end of his administration, he cut this deal. He got out of the job and was immediately appointed to a high level position by his good friend Vladimir Putin. So that's an example of trust.
Okay, interesting. So you mentioned a German chancellor. That makes for a good segue to the current German chancellor, albeit a German chancellor who is soon running out of time. And that is, of course, Angela Merkel. There is an election coming up, I believe, in October 2021. Russell, do I have that right? It's an October election.
It's coming October.
It's a good time to start talking about the end of the Merkel era and her legacy. It's funny, I'm doing a broadcast later today with Ion Hirsi-Ali, who you may know, Russell, has written a book, and the book talks about violence in Europe, violence perpetrated by migrants against women in Europe, and she points a finger at Merkel for this, that Merkel in 2015 welcomed migrants, and I think her exact words were, "We can do this." And what Ion is contending years later is that this has been a disaster for Germany. You look at Merkel, though, Russell, and you start thinking about her legacy. What comes to mind for you?
She's been extraordinarily successful as a politician. This is the end of her fourth period, I believe. Mm-hmm. What she has done is move her party, the Christian Democratic Union, part of the CDU-CSU coalition that is the conservative party in Germany. She's moved it to the center. And that has left a space on the right, which has led to the development of a new party, the Alternative for Germany, which is sometimes characterized as having an extremist character. That's a very specific term in German political language. This is new in the history of the Federal Republic. So there's a new far right, thanks to Merkel's having moved the conservatives to the left, if we can follow that political arithmetic. Secondly, surely one of the key hallmarks of her administration has been the 2015 decision to open the borders. Right. This was a unilateral and peremptory decision to suspend the so-called Dublin rule, which meant that refugee seekers would have to seek asylum in the first country in Europe which they entered. And by definition, that's not Germany unless you come by plane. Mm-hmm. And that would have meant that the refugees should have stayed in Greece or Bulgaria or Italy. She opened the borders. Why she did that, there's an extensive discussion about this. She had received terrible press in Europe because of her handling of the Greek debt crisis previous to that. And she wanted to soften her image. Perhaps she was truly motivated by some kind of humanitarian concern. There were people in distress. There's a not necessarily only cynical view that saw the massive inflow of immigrants, about a million or so, as a way to correct Germany's demographic problem. Now it has a pool of inexpensive labor that it didn't have before. But what that also did, because of the unilateral character of the decision, was create a crisis within the European Union. And here's the real tragedy, if you will, of Merkel and her legacy. She was nothing if not adamantly in support of greater European Union integration. Mm-hmm. But this decision split Europe. And that fracture continues until today.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about her COVID record and how that will play out in the fall election.
COVID will play out poorly for the Christian Democrats. Merkel, of course, won't be running again. She has decided to end her career, her political career. Mm-hmm. Or let me say her career in German politics. Who knows what's in stake for her in the future. Initially, people trusted her. She had a kind of aura of expertise. She's a scientist by training. She's a physicist.
Right.
There was a kind of filial love for her in the country. A lot of people called her Mutti, Mama.
Okay, their mother. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe she had a kind of sort of Queen Elizabeth the First symbolic standing in German culture. In the course of the year, her tendency was toward extraordinarily strict lockdown mechanisms. It's too early for anybody to say what was right anywhere. We're not out of this, but there've been a lot of different models, and the Germans opted for one of the strictest. There's been a lot of dissatisfaction with this, especially in light of a number of specific failures, a failure in the purchase of the vaccine, a failure in the rollout of the vaccine, and a failure in a lot of waffling about the terms with which the lockdown could end. I read today in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, so think Germany's New York Times, a headline that Germany is now the world champion in excuses. people are very dissatisfied. The impact on the economy, we know.
Right. And what you're suggesting is the fall election could lead to a very simple discussion. And that discussion is really between advocates of freedom and advocates of more, well, I think the word is dictatorship, but just more, I guess, strict measures on society, right?
Well, I've written about this. One German philosopher has written, what we need is more freedom. That is, we have to have sensible steps, masks, social distancing, but we don't have to shut everything down because freedom is what the state should provide. On the other hand, there's been another voice that has called explicitly for more dictatorship. That is, a stronger hand in controlling society. Fall election. The COVID handling by the conservative government will not be a plus for the conservative government. The Conservative Party, the CDU, will nonetheless receive the largest fraction of votes, but instead of in the mid-high 30s, it's likely to be in the low 30s. So if it goes below 30s, that'd be an earthquake. And the question is going to be, what kind of coalition will end up ruling in Berlin? There hasn't been an absolute majority for decades. So the character of the future coalition will have a lot of significance for American foreign policy.
All right. I want to talk about cancel culture in Germany, Russell, but I also want to talk about it in France. So why don't we segue into French politics now? And that would be Monsieur Macron, who is not up until May 2022. Unlike Merkel, he is seeking another term. He will be challenged once again from the extreme right by Le Pen. There was an article today, Russell, in the Liberation newspaper. I'm not sure if you follow the Liberation or not. And what they had a headline, and the headline included a voter saying, quote, "I've blocked the far right in the past, and this time it's over." And what the article suggests, too, is that there's more traction for Le Pen this time around, who I think Russell got something like 34% of the vote in 2017. I know there was a Harris Interactive poll that showed the National Rally Party up around 48%. So it gets to this idea of how French politics are being driven. And I mentioned cancel culture for this, and this is more of the Liberation article. The complaint is that Macron has shifted too far to the right. And what they point to is, the government just openly courting right-wing voters, and then also the higher education minister, Frédéric Vidal, warning about the spread of his word, quote, Islamo-leftism in French universities, which is a term is often used by the far right to demonize leftists who defend Muslims. So that's a long way of leading to Macron's fortunes. But if we view him, Russell, as the heir apparent to the European leader overall, if you will, let's talk about where Macron stands right now.
Well, the election's still a ways away, but you've pointed exactly to some of the key issues that are motivating the French public. In September, Macron gave an important speech in the Pantheon for the 150th year anniversary of the declaration of the Third Republic. This is the republic that emerged during the Franco-Prussian War. And he insisted at that point on defending what he calls republican values. That is, the values of the French Republic. They're very close to the values of the Declaration of the Independence, equality, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. In France, one would add to that the insistence on laïcité, on secularism, which is analogous to our freedom of religion, but it works in a somewhat different way. During the same fall, trial of the culprits in the Charlie Hebdo murders of several years ago, the attack on the satirical magazine, took place, and this brought back all those memories. That satirical magazine had been attacked for publishing caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. A high school teacher in suburban Paris wanted to discuss this topic, freedom of speech, as part of the civic course. And in that context, he showed the caricatures. Because of that, he was targeted by Islamists online, and he was, in fact, beheaded in France. This has exacerbated matters. So there's a lot of concern about a return of Islamism, what in French they call separatism, the development of ghettoized communities that don't integrate into, Macron again, Republican values, and the spread of a certain kind of anti-Republican, anti-secular ideology in French universities. The, as you quoted, the Islamo-leftism, it is different than, but it is, I suppose, culturally analogous to the spread of critical race theory in the United States. Significant parts of the French public are concerned with this. How does this play into electoral politics? Some say, oh, Macron is only playing to the right in order to shore himself up against Le Pen. But I believe he sincerely believes in what he's saying and is concerned with the developments in French society. Let's remember that it's not only about Macron, La République en Marche, his new party, and Le Pen's Rassemblement National. There is also Les Républicains, the Republicans, which is the more traditional conservative party. I think that they may represent a challenge to Macron as well. In any case, what one can see in France is an extreme case of the utter collapse of the traditional left-wing parties. The defeat of the of Labour in the UK is nothing compared to the disappearance of the left in France.
Interesting. Let's talk a bit about COVID, Russell. There is a parallel to U.S. politics in that school reopenings is an issue in France, but there is one enormous difference, whereas finding a COVID vaccine is an enormous success story, almost a miracle here in the United States. For the French, it's a bit of a slap against national pride, is it not? Because French biotech did not deliver.
There was a lot of disappointment that the French company Sanofi did not deliver. Maybe it will still deliver, but it's really the caboose in the story here. And that's a shame. One analysis is that this has to do with Sanofi's strategy over the years of cutting back on its research wing. This is part of sometimes called the financialization of the industry, trying to get short-term profits and therefore undercutting the substance of the program of the company. This is just one more in a long litany of failures by European countries in the battle against COVID, beginning with the initial decision to put it all in the hands of the EU in order to demonstrate European solidarity. Very quickly, smart national leaders figured out that that isn't going to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. That includes Angela Merkel, and started to circumvent the EU. And that's where the mess began.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the French experience with lockdowns. I've seen a lot of videos of the French defying the lockdown and partying, people ignoring curfews deliberately. Did it surprise you, Russell, or is this sort of an extension of the French culture?
It did not surprise me on two scores. First, the solutions, the programs proposed in France were typically centralized and top down. Unlike Germany and unlike the United States, France doesn't have a kind of regional federalism. Can't delegate these decisions to local governors, or only with great difficulty. That's beginning to happen now, where different conditions are leading to different solutions on the ground. But that has come very late in the story in France. So you have a centralized disciplinary model. And on the other hand, you have a France that is willing to strike to enjoy the chaos of ground level politics. Frankly, what surprised me most was the violent opposition to lockdown measures in the Netherlands, of all places. That I did not see coming. But there were also protests and examples of defiance in Germany too, which one would not have expected. So I think that and when we look back on this COVID year, and may it only be about a year, people will think a lot about the policies that have been announced from above, whether from the president, the governor, the chancellor, the president of the republic, etc. But we also have to think about what people really did. And my sense is that in many cases, even when there weren't strict directives, a lot of people acted responsibly. And that's not just a cultural observation. It suggests a kind of political philosophical orientation that we should rely more on individual responsibility and not on the police state to manage a crisis like this.
So, Russell, who is the Thatcher to Joe Biden's Reagan, or who is the Tony Blair to Bill Clinton in this new relationship between Joe Biden and Europe? Is there a natural partner for him?
There is not. We don't know who will succeed Angela Merkel. None of the candidates really is convincing right now. As I said before, the coalition that emerges may prove problematic for the United States. Perhaps we'll return to that. Macron, of course, would like to be the partner, but his popularity is not strong. He has tried to carve out a profile of an advocate of a relatively independent Europe. He wants to have a strategic autonomy, as he phrases it. No one is quite sure what that means. The Germans try to maintain the fiction of a strong relationship with France, but they don't like it because they much more prefer to be catered to by the American American military. Maybe in an odd twist of things, it could be Boris Johnson, although he's no longer European.
He had the great haircut. Have you seen his hair lately, by the way?
Well, you know, in the
it wasn't great to begin with.
In the COVID year, everybody gets passed for it's a bad hair year.
Okay, fair point. Russell, are you familiar with the work of a gentleman named Léon Victor Auguste Bourgeois?
I am not. Who is that?
He is the answer to the great trivia question of name a Frenchman who won the Nobel Peace Prize. And he claimed it in 1920. I mention this because one thing we haven't talked about today is Iran and Europe's view on Iran, the Biden administration view on Iran. This is something else you study, I know, and it's probably a topic of another podcast. But let me paint a scenario to you. Increasing tension between the U.S. and Iran, maybe starting to look like more of a military conflict, if not an all-out war, just escalated tension. Is there a role for Macron or someone else in Europe to step in and be the middle person? That's why I asked the Nobel question, because this historically is how you get a Nobel Peace Prize. You step in and prevent something awful from happening. So could you see Macron doing that, Russell, or is this just strictly a U.S. and Iran situation to work out?
The Biden administration has been eager to return to the JCPOA. Right. I think for multiple reasons. A significant one is because it was the Trump departure was viewed as a blow to U.S.-European relations. That right. is, one aspect of our current Iran policy is about appeasing the Europeans, right? Not the effect it has in the Gulf. Right. Having said that, I don't see Macron playing that bourgeois role as being the mediator. He ran into an extraordinary conflict with President Erdogan of Turkey just recently. That seems to have calmed down. But although he would like to profile himself in foreign policy, he does not succeed at this. He has no successful foreign policy track record. Let me give you a different take on what might happen in Iran. At this point, I frankly don't believe that the Iranians want a solution. They'd prefer to have the sanctions lifted, but what they really want is the bomb. And they will get it with a new JCPOA or not. And the question for the United States and maybe for some other countries, notably Saudi Arabia and Israel and maybe the Europeans, but who knows, is whether we're comfortable with a nuclear, with an Iran with nuclear weapons who would turn into another North Korea. We can live with North Korea. Can we live with that in Iran as well? I don't think that's a good solution, but I could imagine people saying that that's a prospect. The Europeans are just out of their depth in this. The European interest in having commercial opportunities in Iran is no longer a real piece of the game. I think the Europeans still think that way, but that's not what it's about. The difference between North Korea and Iran is that Iran has been driven consistently by 40 plus years of virulent anti-Americanism. An Iran armed with nuclear weapons would be a dangerous country. There's been discussion in German think tank circles that heretofore the Germans have thought of the primary goal. Germany's primary national interest is avoiding war in the Gulf. That would mean that they would have accepted a nuclear Iran if a war was the only way to avoid that. I'm seeing some shifting on that, and that they might be prepared to accept a military strike in order to prevent nuclear proliferation rather than to see an armed Iran. The Germans aren't going to do this, right? Believe me. But there are a number of other candidates who might. I'm not advocating that, but I think that's the way that this discussion is going. I said before that the real Iranian goal is to get to the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. There's another Iranian goal, given its congenital anti-Americanism, and that is it wants to humiliate the United States.
Right.
It does not want to have a diplomatic solution where Zarif and Secretary of State Tony Blinken shake hands and smile. That's not what they're interested in. They want to have Tony Blinken look like those American sailors who were on that captured boat with their hands tied behind their back.
Exactly. Russell, based on what you study, what you know, what you follow, can the Iranians build a bomb without further technological help from France and Germany?
I think they're on their way, and I'm not sure that France and Germany are their key sources. I suspect China, North Korea, maybe even Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when it comes to sanctions and all that, it's Western Europe is not really the focus then.
The West Europeans did their best to make efforts to undercut the sanctions of the Trump regime. Mm-hmm. At this point, they seem to be getting more on board with the Biden regime, which suggests that for them too, the issue was maybe less the real outcome in Iran than the embrace from the United States. Again, let me underscore that there's a real world impact of policies. What can we do to stop the Iranians? And then there's, a semiotic version, a symbolic aspect to it, and that is the transatlantic relationship. Mm-hmm. And for people in the Atlanticist community, really on both sides of the pond, the Trump steps represented a kind of blow to their self-understanding, to their narcissism. Mm-hmm. And Biden is trying to heal that wound. That's separate from stopping the Iranians from getting a bomb.
Right. Final question for you, Russell, and I'll let you go. Cancel culture in France and Germany. We understand cancel culture here in America. I'm talking to you. You're in San Francisco. Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, and a host of past American individuals have been the victim of cancel culture, the desire to remove them from schools. Poor old Dr. Seuss came under the microscope this week. We have to get rid of six of Dr. Seuss's books because apparently they are offensive. But when we talk about cancel culture in France and Germany, Russell, what exactly is being canceled?
The situation is different in the two countries. In France, there's been the spread of a kind of ideology, the Islamo-leftism, that has an impact in the in instruction in the universities. And of course, you have the case of the Samuel Paty, the high school teacher who was beheaded. That's a pretty gross version of cancellation. Macron sees that as a genuine danger. Following the Paty murder, there was an attack in a cathedral in Nice. So there's a history of Islamist attacks on members of the French public, including Muslims. So that's an extreme version of cancel culture. To his credit, in the President Macron, in that Pantheon speech to which I referred earlier, tried to distinguish French culture from American in his insistence that he opposes removing of statues. In his version, the French Republic is not just what started in 1789, but draws on the whole French national history. So he doesn't want to have a removal of the commemorations of this king or that king. Huh? He embraces the whole of French history and doesn't want to cherry pick it. That's very different from what we're seeing in the United States today. In Germany, there have been numerous cases of attacks on scholars for proposing positions that are viewed as not politically correct. So this means that lectures have been stopped. It means that there have been demands that journals retract articles that have been published. There was the case of the linguist Rudolf Stoeber in Bamberg, who published an article critical of the sort of gender-specific newspeak. It works a little differently in German than in the United States, but it's the pronoun problem that we faced. Can we say he and she, or is always they now? Huh? He published an article critical of that, and instead of mobilizing responses to that, his opponents tried to get the journal to retract it and to have the editorial board issue an apology. So that's more sort of the New York Times version of response to cancel culture. But there've also been for that matter, attacks from the right, excuse me, from the left, no, from the right on liberal and left professors, trying to get them canceled as well. So what we see in Germany is a more extensive threat to academic freedom and intellectual life.
Very good. And final question, Russell, why is cancel culture violent in Europe, whereas it's not as it strikes me as here in America, Russell, cancel culture is people lose jobs, articles disappear off of websites, books are not published anymore. But in terms of beheadings that we see in France, for example, why in France does it become violent?
Well, in France, that cancel culture overlaps with the Islamist problem, and there's a history of terrorism. I think there's a transformation of terrorism from conspiratorial organizations to lone wolves, but who are nonetheless radicalized on the internet. I think I would not say that it's nonviolent in the United States if I think of the riots that went on during the summer.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
If a city council decides to take down a statue of Abraham Lincoln, that's due process. If a mob does it, it's lynch law. I'm here in San Francisco, and around the corner from me in Golden Gate Park, we lost a monument to that great defender of the Confederacy, Ulysses S. Grant.
He once owned a slave, right?
But yeah, and he also defeated the Confederacy.
Yes.
I think that if one were to use the same kind of metrics, there's probably no person to whom we should have any memorial, because there's always some skeleton in the closet, whether it's how the hero of these values mistreated that group, or some misuse of language. We could move to a model in which all streets are just numbered rather than named. Right. This is just the bizarre craziness that we're in right now. I'm reminded of that scene in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, if I'm allowed to still refer to Shakespeare, where the mob comes across Cinna the poet, and they mistake him for Cinna the conspirator, and they therefore attack him. I think that's the logic that leads to the toppling of Grant and Lincoln.
And is there any lesson for America to learn from what Europe is experiencing right now, Russell, or are these just two continents with different sets of issues?
No, I think they're very similar issues. Of course, they're nuanced according to their local cultures. The secularism in France is distinctive. The particular German history of the 20th century is distinctive. And the United States has its own distinctive history. Nonetheless, all of these three countries, and these are two countries that we often think of ourselves as like, are going through similar contortions right now about the possibility of having a positive national self-image. And there's a lot of advocacy on the street and in parts of the press that no, you don't deserve a positive self-image. That patriotism itself is a crime. The comparison with our longstanding European allies was pretty much prohibited during the Trump administration, because here in the U.S., everything was seen through the lens of pro or anti-Trump. That's over. And now we think we can understand that some of the difficulties that we face in culture, some of the difficulties that we face with COVID are not unique to the United States.
All right. Folks, if you go into Twitter and find Russell Berman's account, which is at Russell Berman SF, that's RussellBermanSF, you'll find the following description: teacher, writer, reader, telos editor, public intellectual, and cyclist. Russell, my friend, I hope you're getting back on the bike soon.
Soon.
Okay. And you got your shots. I hope you're feeling well. And hey, I look forward to having you back down at Stanford sometime. Good to have you back on campus.
Looking forward to returning.
Thank you, Russell. Enjoyed the conversation very much. You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word, get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online, as I mentioned, at www.hoover.org. While you're there, why don't you sign up for the daily reports? If I haven't pushed enough your way, I'm going to give you one more task. Sign up for the daily report. It delivers the best work of Russell Berman and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. Again, pretty simple to do that. Go back to that same publications tab and you'll find the daily report waiting for you. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's spelled at Hoover INST. I mentioned Russell Berman's Twitter feed. Once again, it's at Russell Berman SF. Berman spelled B-E-R-M-A-N, at Russell Berman SF. I'm also on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Bill Whalen CA. Whalen spelled W-H-A-L-E-N. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Matters of Policy and Politics. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.